This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Heartland Community College is offering help after personal data for up to several thousand people was stolen in a cyber attack last fall.
That's basically a credit monitoring service. And that would be relevant in instances if a Social Security number had been impacted.
Some Social Security numbers have been posted on the dark web. The college says it's beefing up security. Plus, the community says goodbye to another former mayor of Bloomington. Hear about the long and twining road for hemp growers. And a Central Illinois biochemist holds forth about the effort to combat superbugs, antibiotic-resistant bacteria. That and a news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT.
Support for Sound Ideas comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology, the best hearing device center in the Pantograph Reader's Choice Awards for the sixth year in a row. Bloomington Normal Audiology thanks the listeners and their continued vote of confidence as the leaders in hearing and technology. With a practice featuring five doctors, including two who wear hearing devices themselves, BNA takes a genuine interest in each patient and helps you keep hearing the most important sounds of your life. More information at bnaudiology.com. Bloomington Normal Audiology, here for you.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let's run down some of the day's top stories. The McLean County Chamber of Commerce Political Action Committee is explaining why it declined to endorse a candidate for mayor of Normal. Incumbent Chris Coos is a small business owner and a member of the chamber, but Chamber PAC Chair Megan O'Neill Rogozinski says the town hasn't done a good job of listening to the public on issues.
So I think there's this false sense of reality within the government center of the town of Normal.
She says it's time for change, but it declined to endorse Coos's challenger, Mark Tiratilli, either.
Mr. Tiratilli didn't necessarily have the understanding that we were hoping for. He might be there in the future, but he wasn't there yet.
The election is April 6th. Early voting is underway. Former Peoria Congressman and U.S. Department of Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood reportedly says he needed money for home repairs when he took $50,000 from the associate of a foreign national in 2012. That's according to a non-prosecution agreement released in full by the U.S. Department of Justice. LaHood was serving in the Obama administration at the time. He reportedly took the money with the understanding it was from a Lebanese-Nigerian billionaire and failed to disclose it on two government ethics forms. In 2017, LaHood initially denied ever receiving the money to FBI agents, but after the agents showed him a copy of the $50,000 check, he reportedly told them he received it as a loan but couldn't recall the terms and had never been asked to repay it in the 5 years since. He also didn't disclose he knew the source of the money. An improving coronavirus picture in February failed to nudge unemployment lower in Bloomington Normal. The Illinois Department of Employment Security says the Twin Cities area jobless rate of 5.1% in February remains almost twice as high as in the same month last year. That's about the same comparative difference as for each of the last several months. The size of the workforce in the Twin Cities area in February was about 86,200 people. That's down 6,300 jobs compared to February of last year. State numbers show the number of people working in the Bloomington-Normal area is slightly higher than in January of this year, though some of that may be a seasonal variation or hiring at Rivian. The February workforce is significantly smaller than it was in the fourth quarter of last year. McLean County health officials report 77 new COVID-19 cases as the county's testing positivity rate decreased for the first time in 2 weeks. The positivity rate dipped just 0.1 percentage point, down to 5.3%. The new cases were found in a batch of about 1,600 test results returned overnight. One additional McLean County resident is hospitalized with COVID-19, bringing the total to 31 hospitalized patients. Just over 73,000 doses of the COVID-19 vaccine vaccine have been administered in McLean County, according to the Health Department data. That's up about 1,700 doses in the last 24 hours. Police have captured a man wanted for murder in a Bloomington shooting last year. A U.S. Marshals task force arrested 22-year-old Kevon Moon of Chicago in Lafayette, Indiana. His bond is set at $3 million. 20-year-old Jaleel Johnson died from a bullet to the head last October in the 1600 block of Iowa Street near Sunnyside. Two other men, ages 22 and 27, were hospitalized in critical condition following the incident. Police also served a murder warrant on 27-year-old Malcolm Johnson of Riverdale, Illinois. Johnson was already in the McLean County Jail on another matter. Police say a third man is still at large. He's 22-year-old James Moon of Bloomington, and officers say he should be considered armed and dangerous. Opioid deaths continue to rise in Illinois. Nearly 2,900 people died from overdoses of opiates last year. That's a 30% increase over 2019. The numbers come from provisional data from the Illinois Department of Public Health. 83% of those cases involved fentanyl-laced drugs. State health officials also report black men account for the most opioid overdoses, but the biggest increase seen over the year has been among Hispanic and Latinx populations. Two of Illinois' six nuclear power plants are scheduled to close later this year, and nuclear power proponents are working to raise awareness in hopes of saving the facilities. Exelon announced late last year it plans to decommission the Byron and Dresden generating stations in northern Illinois in the fall, citing financial concerns. Both stations are licensed to operate another 10 to 20 years. Kent Bug is the superintendent of the Coal City School District, which receives at least half its revenue from taxes generated by the Dresden station. He says the announcement caught him off guard.
If you knew that in, 10, 15, 20 years, you were going to lose 50% of your income, it wouldn't be easy, but you could make plans to figure out how you're still going to function. If I told you you were going to lose 50% of your revenue tomorrow, that's a very, very different situation.
Opponents of nuclear power say it can be dangerous and its waste can harm the environment. Currently, more than half of Illinois' electricity comes from nuclear power, and 90% of Illinois' carbon-free power comes from nuclear. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology. BNA continues its educational video series, Hear My Story, with local patient Robert Handley.
The providers at Bloomington Normal Audiology are all doctors of audiology. They have gone that next step, so they're medical professionals.
Robert's full story can be found at bnaudiology.com.
You're listening to Bloomington Normal's Public Media. Former Bloomington Mayor and McLean County Board Member Rich Buchanan is being remembered as a dedicated public servant who enjoyed the work of serving the people he represented. Buchanan spent more than four decades in public service. He died Tuesday at age 81. Eric Stock looks back at Buchanan's legacy.
Rich Buchanan served two terms as Bloomington mayor in the late 1970s and 80s after two terms on the city council. In an interview with WGLT in 2019, Buchanan reflected on his time leading the city.
But I just loved being mayor. I think I was well received. People didn't beat up on me too much.
Former mayor of Normal, Paul Harmon, served on the Normal Town Council when Buchanan was mayor of Bloomington. Harmon says Buchanan fostered a new spirit of cooperation between the Twin Cities.
He is the first mayor of Bloomington who worked very hard to work with the mayor of Normal, Dick Godfrey, at the time. It was the first time that the mayors of the two cities had a decent relationship, as far as I'm concerned.
Harmon says Buchanan recognized the town of Normal was growing up and had plenty to offer Bloomington.
Normal was much more significant in the relationship than it had been in the past. So I think Rich recognized that.
Harmon says that partnership helped Bloomington Normal and McLean County forge an agreement to entice what would become Mitsubishi Motors to build a plant in Normal. That enterprise zone agreement of tax incentives is still in place today. Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner says he worked on various projects with Rich and wife Judy Buchanan for decades, long before Renner became mayor in 2013. He saw Rich Buchanan as a rare breed in politics.
He was always wonderful to work with. He was always honest. He was a straight shooter. He didn't have hidden agendas. And that's often rare. We see that that's rare in public service.
Renner says even when Buchanan opposed an idea, he never made it personal. Renner says Buchanan was always happy to talk through differences. In fact, Renner says that was part of public service Buchanan seemed to love.
But he was certainly somebody that even if you disagreed, you could sit down and chat with him and talk about things and have a, well, he was a teetotaler, so you wouldn't sit down and have a beer with him, but the equivalent of a beer.
Yes, Buchanan didn't drink, yet he served more than three decades on Bloomington's Liquor Commission. Here was Rich Buchanan in 2019.
I loved going in the bars. I'd come home at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning after watching the bars close. You don't have to drink to enjoy things.
More recently, Buchanan served on the McLean County Board until 2017, when he had to resign because of complications from Alzheimer's disease. Sonia Reese served more than two decades on the Normaltown Council. She became close friends with Rich and Judy Buchanan. Reese and Judy Buchanan had both worked in health care. Judy Buchanan has been a health care advocate for many years. Reese noticed how well the Buchanans worked as a team.
They were so supportive of each other, involved in so many ways. And when you see that, it's not one plus one. It's almost one plus one equals 10 because they put all their energies behind their projects.
Reese says she learned early on Rich Buchanan had a thoughtful approach to handling thorny issues. When Buchanan was mayor of Bloomington, Reese worked for Mennonite Hospital. That is now Carl Broman Medical Center. Mennonite asked the city council for permission to take over a city street for a planned hospital expansion. Reese says Buchanan helped guide debate on the city council to address concerns. He eventually gained enough support for the plan to pass.
The meeting went on until midnight, when he finally kind of felt that now he had the votes to pass it. And they did. And there was joy all over that area with some of us that had waited through that meeting just to hear that.
The McLean County Museum of History honored Rich and Judy Buchanan as McLean County History Makers in 2019. Kibler Brady Russman Memorial Home in Bloomington is handling funeral arrangements. Citing pandemic concerns, the family is planning a private service for now. The family plans to have a public celebration of Buchanan's life once it is safer to do so. Buchanan was 81. I'm Eric Stock.
Rich Buchanan is Bloomington's second former mayor to die in the last month. Judy Markowitz, the city's first woman and first Jewish mayor, died in February. Mayor Terry Renner says flags at City Hall and city offices will be flown at half staff for the next few days in Rich Buchanan's honor. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. After last year's cyber attack on Heartland Community College computer systems, the other shoe has dropped for current and former students and staff. Personal information on thousands of people has been posted on an unsavory area of the Internet. The October 5th attack caused a cascade of systems failures as what is believed to be a group of cyber criminals took down more than 120 servers at the college in Normal, encrypted data, and issued a ransom demand. At the time, Heartland said it did not have evidence personal data was stolen, merely taken hostage. That changed when one of the security firms Heartland hired found personal data of people associated with Heartland posted on the dark web. The dark web is a section of the Internet not indexed by search engines, and only accessible through a specialized browser used to keep information anonymous. It's sometimes used to buy and sell illicitly obtained information. Heartland Vice President of Finance and Administration Letitia Trepak says the exposure puts nearly 3,900 people at risk of identity theft.
We are fortifying our cybersecurity initiatives on campus. We've, of course, learned a great deal through this unfortunate experience.
The consulting firm Tetra Defense investigated further. In December, Heartland sent out a letter notifying some people their data might have been exposed. In late March, a second round of letters went out informing them the attackers had indeed stolen their data. In all, Heartland sent the letters to nearly 3,900 separate people. In part, one read, "We discovered that documents containing your full name, social security number, and financial account information were removed from our network and posted on the dark web in connection with this incident. TREPAC says Heartland has offered those affected a one-year membership in Experian Identity Works Credit 3B, a tool used to help detect identity theft and resolve related issues.
That's basically a credit monitoring service. And that would be relevant in instances if a Social Security number had been impacted.
Heartland officials urge those who receive the letters to take them seriously. Even though they have a Pennsylvania contact address, they are genuine. The retail value of the IdentityWorks service for those whose data is compromised is about $858,000. TREPAC says the cost will be borne by Heartland's insurance carrier. Heartland told those affected that to date the college isn't aware of reports of identity fraud as a direct result of the incident, but data leaks in the wild can be sold and resold for years. That raises the question whether a one-year subscription to the service is enough help.
The question of sufficiency in general is a very good question in these unfortunate incidents. They are increasing in number for all business sectors. I think that everyone should take any reasonable steps to protect their own identity. I know that we're doing whatever we can as a college to assist in that as well.
In the March letter, Heartland said it concluded its document review February 26th, but TREPAC says that might not be the last word.
As this is an ongoing investigation, anytime we receive new information, we take measures, necessary measures. Since the first or initial stages of the investigation, additional information was learned, which prompted us to take action.
The encryption and ransom scheme halted campus operations for more than a week and disrupted the ordinary course of business for a long while. Even now, some minor systems haven't been replaced. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media. When industrial hemp production was legalized in the 2018 Farm Bill, CBD and other cannabinoid products attracted the most attention, but many believe hemp's greatest potential lies in its fibrous and woody stem, which can be used as a sustainable source material in textiles, construction, and automotive parts. For the small group of farmers and others that have focused their attention on fiber production, the road ahead is long and twining. But as correspondent Tori Dahlhoff finds out, the path is still very much worth it.
This is hempcrete. This is actually a building material.
On her family's small farm outside Princeton, Illinois, Rachel Berry, founder and CEO of the Illinois Hemp Growers Association, gives a show and tell of some of the everyday goods that can be made from the fibrous and woody stem of the hemp plant.
First hemp book to be made in 100 years, a book printed.
Since the 2018 Farm Bill that allowed for the production of hemp, farmers and advocates like Berry have worked to bring hemp fiber and grain crops to more farmers' fields in Illinois. The fiber and herd material from hemp has many uses in the manufacturing of textiles, construction materials, car parts, and much more. Hemp could also play a role in the regenerative agriculture movement with its ability to improve soil and water quality and increase farm diversity.
It is an incredibly, incredibly versatile plant, and I think we're just barely scratching the surface of what private industry is going to be able to do with this plant once, you know, the market's a little bit more established.
That's David Lakeman, who oversees cannabis regulation for the Illinois Department of Agriculture. The lack of a market stems from federal prohibitions that discouraged hemp farming as far back as 1937. But there may be a silver lining to hemp's decades-long ostracism from the mainstream. The reintroduction of hemp has opened a door into a new world of possibilities for young farmers like Rebecca Dwyer, whose family has farmed conventional corn and soy in Woodford County since the 80s.
It's really, really, really difficult as a young farmer to try and get started in this business. So that's why when my uncle said, you know, hey, like, let's diversify. What do you know about hemp? I jumped on it.
But 2021 may be her last go at hemp fiber, for a while anyway, without some sign of a viable marketplace. That market may someday exist with sustainably minded manufacturers like Natural Fiber Welding.
We could use hemp. The issue for us is we need repeatable inputs, repeatability at least at that scale of hundreds of pounds.
That's Luke Haverhals. He's the founder and CEO of Natural Fiber Welding. They're a Peoria-based startup company that has expanded steadily in recent years with products like Murum, which is a plant-based leather technology that has attracted investment from clothing companies like Ralph Lauren and Allbirds. Despite the interest in hemp, Natural Fiber Welding sits on the opposite side of a critical supply chain gap from farmers like Dwyer. They are both waiting for progress in hemp processing.
It's kind of the chicken and the egg, and we laid the egg and now we're waiting for the chicken to grow up, I guess. But we have to wait for that fully developed processor, because I don't have the time and my uncle doesn't have the time for us to really process it ourselves on a large scale, profitable way.
Sustainable markets for hemp fiber and herd will take many years to develop, which in the long run may be for the better. The gold rush mentality that consumed the early days of hemp legalization predictably resulted in overproduction and disappointing prices for CBD products, something that Rob Davies of Mississippi Fiberworks says should be a teachable moment for the development of the hemp fiber industry.
CBD, quite frankly, I don't think has been really a very good success story for Illinois, and I'm not pointing any fingers. It was just something that just kind of fell over.
Mississippi Fiberworks is one of numerous organizations in the state pushing for a measured and cooperative approach to hemp fiber industries.
Eventually, we get to the point where we're bringing some wealth back to small rural communities, and we're helping family farmers and, of course, protecting our watersheds and the environment by doing so.
And those are points that Rachel Berry agrees should remain at the forefront in the development of industrial hemp in Illinois.
But if you're in this space right now to make money, you're not going to have a good time. This is about building research and resources so that we can collectively work together, move forward, so that when it is time to expand, we all know what we're doing, and hopefully we are all on the same foot as far as sustainable systems and stewardship.
For Peoria Public Radio, I'm Tori Dahlhoff.
You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. Bradley University biochemistry professor Brad Andersch is researching ways to combat drug-resistant bacteria. He's also a Pew Charitable Trust's Superbugs ambassador. Tim Shelley speaks with Andersch.
What's happened is, due to the exposure of bacteria organisms to the different drugs that we use for treating them, is that those bacteria have developed the ability to live in the presence of those drugs, and so they become resistant to it. We see the same thing in agricultural fields. You'll find that some of the plants have become resistant to Roundup. You see the same thing as people talk about viruses, that they can become resistant to some of the drugs that we use for treating them. You saw that a lot in the HIV fight that continues to this day, and that many of those treatments, organisms have become resistant to it. And that's the biggest fear right now, even as we're looking at the current pandemic, is that the virus will eventually have a mutation that will make our current lines of defense inactive against them.
What do we do in response to that?
What we've been doing for the last six decades, really, since the process for producing penicillin on a large scale, which was developed here in Peoria, is to constantly modify the drugs that we're using, or find new drugs that could be used that the organisms have not developed the resistance to. And the problem is that we're no longer doing that as much as we used to. If we think about the issue of drug development, it's incredibly expensive for a company to take on that initiative. There are estimates that it costs, and these are estimates, $1.5 billion to develop a new drug. As you go through all of the development, all the testing, all the federal regulations, and doing all of the clinical trials, and then putting that drug onto the market. And antibiotics are just a different category of medication than we typically think of using, because we use them for very short periods of time. It's very difficult to recover. The investment has to be made, and the large pharmaceutical companies have pulled out of the business because it's not profitable. I mean, they are a business. They have to make a profit, and they can't make a profit. In the United States, 35,000 people per year die of infections due to organisms that we don't have treatments for. 2.4 million people annually in the United States are infected with organisms that have shown resistance to some of the drugs we're using. Thankfully, in most of those cases, they were eventually able to find a drug to treat that infection and clear it. But the fear is that we won't be able to do that much longer. There are some that estimate that by 2050, we could be looking at millions of deaths per year worldwide due to antibiotic-resistant infections if we can't find ways to develop new drugs.
This is kind of where some of your research comes in, right? You're actively doing some research right now on antibiotics, if you could talk a little bit about that.
So what we're trying to do is kind of a twofold approach. One is trying to find how we can modify compounds to make them more effective at either inhibiting the growth or killing the organism. Along those lines, then, as we're trying to develop new compounds, we're also trying to figure out what mode of action they have and if we could possibly find an alternative strategy for killing the organisms. But that's just one mechanism. If we can find a different mechanism that the organisms haven't been exposed to previously, we could potentially then have another opportunity to buy us a few years. And that's really all we're doing, is we're trying to keep ahead and just buy time. Where a lot of the research really needs to be happening is understanding how the organisms are developing this resistance. And that's where it kind of comes into understanding the role of basic research and the funding mechanisms that support basic research. Developing new drugs is a temporary solution. It buys you time. It doesn't solve the real problem. It will always have resistance developing.
That's Bradley University biochemist Brad Anders talking with Tim Shelley. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.